And we're holding on to Yud Amud Beis, the second line from the bottom. Zman Nosi Tzorich Gdi Simen. These are the catchwords for the next three things that the Gemara is going to teach us. We started learning yesterday about the dinim of Ibur HaChodesh and Ibur HaShana, how Beis Din sits to decide when to declare Rosh Chodesh and to decide whether there's going to be a leap year. So we talked about that when it comes to declaring a leap year, the Tanakhama said that it's enough to have three, and Rav Shimon Gamliel had said that you start out with three who decide whether we even need to start figuring it out. Then if they decide, if the majority of them vote that yes, then they add another two dayanim and they start deliberating on the details. And if they decide that a leap year is in fact needed, then they add another two and they have seven altogether, and then they clear a leap year.
So you
start three, five, and then seven. You start out with three to even decide, because you have a three-step process.
Okay.
First, you need to decide, do we even need to bother checking whether next year is going to be a leap year? Now, to give an example, the Gemara is going to go through, we're going to go through in the sugya over here, a number of different factors that they have to consider whether to make a leap year or not. So let's take one of them, one which is fairly simple to understand, ala tkufa. So if Tkufas Nisan, the spring equinox, is going to come out after Pesach has started, then or after the second or third day of Pesach or whatever, then you need to declare a leap year. So let's say, for example, this past year, Pesach was very late in the secular year. So this coming year, for example, Pesach is scheduled to be sometime in early April. That's a good few weeks after the Tkufa. There's no need to make a leap year because of that. So you might conceivably have, they say, do we need to decide whether this year is a leap year? Well, let's look on the calendar. We find if we don't make a leap year, Pesach's going to come in early April. If we make a leap year, Pesach's already going to be in the middle of May. We definitely don't want that. Therefore, there's no need to bother with it.
Earlier the better.
Not earlier the better. But we don't want it before the spring equinox either, which is late March or early April, but you don't want it too much later than it either. Now, let's say they decide, yes, you know what, we have to think about it. Do we need a leap year this coming year? So then we need two more dayanim. You have five of them to sit down and figure out the details. What are the various factors and how do they play out? What date can we expect the tkufa? What date can we calculate the tkufa is going to be? What's going to be the status? What can we expect is going to be as far as the newborn lambs and goats, which we're going to need for the Korban Pesach, and the Gemara mentions that later on as a factor, and different other things like that, that are going to factor in whether we're going to make a leap year or not. Then if they decide...
Animals are born
usually a certain time of year. They're usually born. So many of them actually are born during the summertime, which is why the Gemara discusses in Masechet Rosh Hashanah, which is why we have Elul, Rosh Chodesh Elul, or Rosh Chodesh Tishrei, according to the different opinions, is Rosh Hashanah L'maisa Behema. But many of them are also born in the late winter, early spring, so we need to know even if they're not born, whatever, the point is we need to see. We can take a look and see. Or are they mature enough to be brought as korbanos? They have to be only 8 days old in principle, but still, you know. So, that's a factor that they consider also. So those kinds of factors are what they're deliberating among the five of them. Then if they decide among the five of them, the majority says, yes, we need a leap year, then we add another two dayanim, and they declare officially there's going to be a leap year this year, there's going to be two others.
So seven is the max.
So seven is what we end off with. So the Gemara says, Tana Rabbanan, Ein Ma'abri Nesashana Elabim Zhumanim. When we declare an Ibriyar, we can do it only with those who are invited to it. So it's not just going to be any random seven members of the Sanhedrin who are going to be there to make the declaration. They need to be invited that they're going to be the ones to do it. And it happened once with Ram Gamliel. Ram Gamliel said, I want seven members of the Sanhedrin to be there, to be there early in the morning in the Aliyah. The Aliyah is the second floor of his house, or the second floor of the Beis Din Shtibl, whatever, which is typically where they would often have the deliberations of Beis Din. We often find throughout Shas, we're going to have a few examples of it on this daf, where the Chachamim would regularly sit in the Aliyah. When they're having a whole gathering, they would have it in the Aliyah. The point is, in other words, the Aliyah is not like the attic, like a place where they have to hide out. It's like the second floor. It's like the main gathering place of the house. In other words, the idea would be, I guess, like the bedroom and the kitchen and whatnot would be on the ground floor, and the reception hall kind of thing, the living room would be on the second floor. Anyway, Hishkimu Motza Shmoina. Rav Gamliel comes there the next morning and he finds there are eight people over there. Omar, he says, Mihu Sha'ola Shaloi Bereshus, who is it that came here without permission? Yered, he should go down, he should leave. Now, how does Rav Gamliel not know in the first place? He said to invite seven. So what happened in the first place? So there are a few explanations. So first of all, so one possibility, Rav Hanano brings up the point, it doesn't mean when he says there needs to be seven, he doesn't necessarily need to name them. He just says there need to be seven. So now, in other words, he himself doesn't know necessarily who is the one who came uninvited. So there's that one possibility. Yes, Marashah says that it may be that the Shliach Beis Din made a mistake and thought that it meant that there need to be seven plus Rav Gamliel. He didn't realize Rav Gamliel himself is going to be one of the seven. So there are a few different ways, actually, of explaining what exactly happened over here. Why, how is it that Rav Gamliel doesn't know? Anyway.
It's also embarrassing for one person.
Well, that says we're going to get to that, but wait. So anyway. So there's a few possibilities. He may have just said generically there should be seven, and he didn't specify who, and now it turns out that there's eight. That's Rabbeinu Hanano. Rabbeinu Yonah understands that he did invite everyone individually, but, yeah, he didn't want to embarrass the person who came uninvited, and therefore he's just saying generically, whoever it is that came uninvited, please leave, expecting that person will then do that.
That's embarrassing right there. You get them
if the person gets up and leaves, then fine, you know, at least he's frustrating himself any further embarrassment, but yeah. Anyway, Marashah says that the vote would be that the Shliach Beis Din misunderstood and thought he's meant to invite seven, not realizing he's supposed to invite only six, and Rav Gamliel himself will be the seventh.
If you have extra one, it hurts, it's a problem.
Yeah, you can't have more than seven, he said. So whoever came shall labor to shus, yeah, that should go down. I mean, there's also the consideration, there is this as well. The fact that they decide, we're going to talk about now in this, as we go through the sugya over here, we're going to talk about the different factors that they would use to determine whether there's a leap year. We don't necessarily want those factors to be publicized to everybody, because then people are going to start thinking, oh, the Chachamim are just manipulating the calendar however they feel like. So those who can be trusted to keep these kinds of secrets, good. Those who not, we don't necessarily want them there. Because then they're going to start questioning, they said this, but maybe it shouldn't really be so, and people are going to start questioning whether there really is a leap year, and that could cause all kinds of problems.
Well, the Shliach went to the Sanhedrin, he wouldn't go to plain people.
No, nevertheless, though, still, the point is that, yeah. Okay. Omad Shmuel HaKotten, so Shmuel HaKotten gets up and says, Ani hu shalitzi shalai b'roshus. I'm the one who came up uninvited. V'loi la'abar ha'shana alitzi. It's true, I didn't come up here to be one of the seven to decide that it's an Ebu Yer. Elumud halocha l'maisa utznachti. I just wanted to learn halacha l'maisa, how do you actually do it? Omaloi, so Rav Gamliel says to him, shave, b'ni, shave, sit, my son, sit, ru'uyas kalashanim kulamis abra al yodcha, you're worthy enough that all years, whenever there needs to be an ibuyo declared, should be through you. Ela kacham v'chachamim, the fact is, the chacham said, ein ma'abanas hashana, ela b'mizumanim law, that we can only make an ibuyo with those who were invited. So, now, as the Gemara is going to explain now, Shmuel HaKotten was one of the ones who was invited. So when Rabbi Gamliel says that to him, he doesn't mean, it's very nice that you're here, but you know what, you don't belong here, please leave. He means, you actually are one of the ones who's supposed to be here. Someone else is here who's not supposed to be here. And the Gemara says, V'loi Shmuel HaKotten hava. In fact, it wasn't Shmuel HaKotten, ela Inish Achrina. It was actually somebody else. Shmuel HaKotten did this in order not to embarrass that person. So he shouldn't have to suffer halbonas upon him. Now, by the way, the Yerushalmi brings, so what do they do in the end? Rabbeinu Hananel brings from the Yerushalmi. Well, the fact is, they still can't do with eight. And whoever it was that was actually the uninvited one didn't want to get up and leave. He didn't want to be embarrassed in public. So what did they do? So they ended up, they said, you know what, fine, we're not going to declare the Ibu Yor today, we'll just sit and learn Torah all day. They sat and delved into and discussed Torah all day. And the next day, they made sure that there really are only seven over there, and Shmuel HaKotten is one of them. So that way they preferred the guy embarrassment, but they also didn't violate the rule of having more than seven for the thing.
So whoever this person was, he had a good day.
So whoever this person had, yeah, he had a good day learning Torah with the elite members of the Sanhedrin, but yeah. Okay. And the Gemara says, Kihodi Yosef Rebbe, as we have an example from a later generation also of someone doing something like that in order not to embarrass the guilty party. One time Rebbe was sitting in the Kodorish, and he was darshining in his Beis Medrash. Vehiriach Reach Shum, and he smelt the smell of garlic. And it bothered him. Rebbe, we find in a number of places, was an istinus. He was a very delicate person, and the smell bothered him. Omar, so he says, Misha Ocho Shum Yetze, whoever ate the garlic, please leave. Omer Rav Chiya v'yotza. Rav Chiya got up and left. Omer Kulon v'yotza, and everybody else also went and left after Rav Chiya. So no more shir. But Shachar Motzu Reb Shimon Ber Rebbe L'Reb Chiya. The next morning, Reb Shimon Ber Rebbe meets up with Reb Chiya. Omalei says, "After who should see out to La'aba? You're the one who caused my father such tsar by eating garlic and your breath smelled bad. How could you do such a thing?" Omalei said, Reb Chiya answers, "Loi tehei kazois b'Yisrael. Such a thing should never happen. Chas v'shalom." It brings on the side over here. It should be that chas v'shalom, that it would have been me. "Loi tehei kazois b'Yisrael. No such thing should ever be suspected among the Jewish people. I know better than that. I know not to bother Rebbe with a smell like that. But rather, in other words, the point is that when I didn't want to embarrass the other guy. So this way, when I left, then everybody else will leave because they're going to know that it wasn't me. They're going to know I would know better than that. So they're going to figure, if I care, they don't want me to be embarrassed. They're going to think maybe I really was the one, and therefore they're going to leave, figuring this way we'll cover for the priya. So he's saying basically that's how it was, but it wasn't actually me who ate it in the first place. Now, Maharsha has a different explanation of what actually happened over here. So he explains that, like this, Rashi is saying that Reb Shimon accused Reb Chiya of eating garlic, and Reb Chiya is saying, "No, I didn't. I was just covering for the one who did." Maharsha explains that actually Reb Shimon's problem was not, he didn't suspect Reb Chiya of eating the garlic in the first place. He knew Reb Chiya knows not to do that. He was bothered. You left, and therefore everybody left. How could you leave and disrupt the shear? Because now, because you left, everybody left. Why did you do that rather than waiting for the guilty party to actually leave? And the answer is that, so you were mitzar, you caused my father pain by leaving the Beis Medrash, and everybody else left, and the shear was interrupted. And Reb Shimon tells him that as much as it's true, loy tehei kazois b'Yisrael, it's true, bittul Torah is a serious avera, but to embarrass another yid publicly is even worse. So loy tehei kazois b'Yisrael, such a thing should definitely not happen among the Jewish people, and therefore it's better to be mevatel Torah rather than to embarrass this yid publicly. So the Gemara says, where did Reb Chiya himself in a later generation learn to act this way? And the answer is made of Meir. He learned it from a story involving Reb Meir. The Gemara is going to go through a whole chain over here, going all the way back to Yeshua and to Moshe Rabbeinu, where one generation learned from an earlier one about how far to go to not embarrass another yid. So after we go through the whole chain of it, we'll talk about a number of Mephoshim deal with the question, why do we need that? Once we have an example from Moshe or from Yeshua, then everybody can learn from that. Why do we need? Reb Chiya is going to learn it from Reb Meir, and Reb Meir from Shmuel HaKotan and so forth. We'll talk about that after we go through the chain. Well, anyway, so what happened with Reb Meir? The Tanya, Maisa v'Isha Achas Shabosel Beis Medrash Yesh Reb Meir. A woman once came to the mayor's Beis Medrash. Omra Loi, she says to him, Rebbe, Echad Mikem Kidshani B'Bia. One of you Talmidim in the Beis Medrash was Mekadosh me with Bia. Now, you're not supposed to do that. You have three valid ways of Kiddushin, Kesef, Shtar, and Bia. But Bia is considered pritzistic. In fact, in the generation or two after the mayor's times, it says in the Gemara, in a couple of places, Rav would give Malkus Maudus to somebody who was Makadish B'Bia. But in any case, the point is, she says, and I don't know who it was. Now, there were Edim, otherwise it wouldn't be a valid Kedushin at all. There has to be Edi Yichud, and we say, Heinein Edi Yichud, Heinein Edi Bia. So we say, so there were Edim, I guess the Edim weren't available, and she doesn't know who the guy was. So now I have a problem, So what do we do as far as the fact that now I'm going to need a get? Omer Reb Meir, because of a get krisus. So Reb Meir stands up and writes for her a get krisus, v'nosamlo, and he gave it to her. He wasn't the one, but this way, not in order, no, it doesn't matter. If you give a get to a random woman who's not married to you, nothing happens. Right. So he wrote one way. And each of the Talmidim then went and wrote one as well. Okay. So the actual guilty party wrote a get as well, and that way it packers her. But this way, nobody ever knows who he is because he's covered for by Reb Meir and all the other Talmidim. So Reb Chiya, in his time with the story with the garlic, learned from Reb Meir in the previous generation to do this kind of thing in order to avoid embarrassing a person. In turn, where did the mayor learn to act that way? And the Shmuel HaKotan, from that story of Shmuel HaKotan involving the seven or eight people, where Shmuel HaKotan said it was me who came uninvited, etc. In turn, where does Shmuel HaKotan learn to behave this way? Mishchanya ben Yechiel. He learns it from Shchanya ben Yechiel, who was a yid in the times of Ezra. So you find in Sefer Ezra, Ezra comes to Eretz Yisrael with his group of Jews a few years, of a year and a half or so after they had finished building the second Beis Mikdash, and he finds out there's a terrible problem of intermarriage. There are many Jewish men who marry Goyish women, and he starts fasting and ripping his clothes and davening, and what are we going to do about this? And then the Pasuk says, Vayan Shchanya ben Yechiel mibnei Elam, Shchanya ben Yechiel from the family of Elam spoke up, Vayomer, and he said, Vayomer Ezra, and he says to Ezra, Anachnu mo'alnu be'lekenu, we have been disloyal to Hashem, Vanoshev noshim nochrias me'ame ha'aretz, and we took wives for Goyish wives from the surrounding nations, Va'ata yesh mikveh v'Yisrael alzois, and now though there's hope for the Jewish people about this, meaning Shchanya tells Ezra, there's still hope, you can gather. You can make everybody divorce their Goyish wives. It's not like it's hopeless. It's not like they're so entrenched in it that it's going to be impossible. You're going to be able to convince everybody to do that. And in fact, the Pesukim go on to describe how Ezra and the Sanhedrin, the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, ordered everybody to gather in Yerushalayim, and Ezra tells them, you have to get rid of your Goyish wives, and everybody agreed, and they set up Bote Dinim for the purpose, and over the next couple of months, they took care of the whole matter. An interesting side point, by the way, is why they need Bote Dinim. If everybody's agreeable to divorce their Goyish wives, and Goyish wives you don't need Bote Dinim for, so what do they need? If everybody's agreeable, then fine, you know, they can just do it on the spot. And the people are saying it's hard, it's a hard job, we have a lot to do. So the point is, because when you think about it, some of these wives may have been converted, but now we have to figure out, was the geiris halacha or not? Even if it was, are the husbands kohenim? If they can't be married to geiris anyway. What's the story with the children? Were the children conceived when the mothers were goitis? Were they conceived after the geiris? And again, is the geiris valid? So you have a lot of complications over there that Bate Dinim need to deal with. But the point is, in other words, who is this Shchanya ben Yechiel?
But if they married goitis, they were...
So that's the thing. If it's outright goitis, then there's nothing to talk about. One second.
Don't we say that when you marry a goy, it's not a marriage? Why should they divorce if they're not married?
That's the point. That's exactly the point. If it was just that they married goitis, then that's it. All they have to do is send them away, and that's that, and send away their children. The complication is that some of these wives may have been converted, but now we have to figure out, was it done kalocha? There's a geiris kalocha, after all. Nowadays, you have the whole issue of miu yehudi. Then also, you would have to figure out, is it a valid geiris? If it was, and there are children, if it was, first of all, is the husband a kohen? Then he still has to divorce her anyway. If she's a Jewish woman, now she's a geiris, but a kohen can't be married to a geiris.
A kohen is not allowed to marry a geiris.
No, that's the point. But nevertheless, it would be a valid, it's a valid marriage, al pi halacha, in the sense that it needs a get to dissolve it. Uh-huh. It's kedushin or toifis. Unlike with a yid and a goita, kedushin are not toifas at all. No divorce is necessary. La'alocha. If a kohen marries a grusha, he's being over on isu. He's being over on isu lav. He's chayav malchus for it if there was a hasra. But nevertheless, it is kedushin or toifas, and he would need to give her a get.
So I've got a kohen's nala and marry
a geiris.
So a
balas truva is another matter. A balas truva, a kohen could marry, although sometimes you have the complications. Sometimes you have a balas truva had relations with somebody who was also to her. If she had relations with a goyish man, for example, then she is in fact also to a kohen. So there are details about that that Bote Dinim nowadays have to work out sometimes. But you have these kinds of complications. So the result was the point is that it took a couple of months process, but everybody was agreeable to it and they did do it. But the point is, Shchanya, what does Shchanya say? He says, we were disloyal to Hashem, and we took Goyish wives. Now, at the end of that perek, after it describes what they did, how they set up the Bote Dinim and all, it gives a list of about a little over 100 men among the Jews who had done this, who had married Goyish wives, and who now divorced them. And Shchanya's name is not on the list, meaning that he himself was not one of the ones who had been disloyal to Hashem. But he's saying, Anachnu, we were disloyal to Hashem, and we married Goyish wives. In other words, he's taking part of the blame on himself, even though he was not on that list, in order not to embarrass the ones. Yeah. Eventually, by the way, the fact that the Pasuk lists their names is a credit to them that even though it must have been very hard to separate from their Goyish wives, they did anyway, so that's a credit to them, and therefore their names deserve to be listed in the Pesukim for all time. But at the time when Shchanya is saying this, of course, he couldn't know that that's yet going to happen.
Does it say why they had to marry Goyish, or is that something?
So the Medrash tells actually what happened over there.
They were killed out, huh?
No. The Medrash tells what happened was when they came to Eretz Yisrael, it was a very, very hard journey from Bavel and from the other 127 countries where they came back to Eretz Yisrael to build the second Beis Mikdash. The travel and all of the burden and all the hardships on there was particularly hard on the Jewish women. So the result was a lot of them lost their good looks from the hard travel and the hard work and everything. So now these men, some of them see these local beautiful goyish ladies and they have a taiva for them. So in fact, there are some of them. The Midrashim described based on Pesukim Malachi. There's an opinion that Malachi himself is Ezra. There's another opinion that they were contemporaries, whatever it was. But Malachi describes there were men who actually divorced their Jewish wives, and the wives are standing there around the Mizbeach and crying to Hashem, "What did we do wrong that we should deserve that our husbands divorced us?" And others of them are like becoming second class in their own homes because their husbands brought in a goyish wife as like their primary wife, and she's like pushed into a corner. So yeah, there was all of this that Ezra had to deal with at the time, yeah. But the point is, in other words, that again, Shania is saying we did the wrong, even though he's not actually one of the ones, because he doesn't want to embarrass those who actually did. So therefore, so we're saying Shmuel HaKatan learned from Shania ben Yechiel to talk that way. Or Shania ben Yechiel Mehecher Gomelah, in turn, where did he learn to talk that way? Mi Yoshua, from the story with Yoshua. So we have the story where Ochan took from the spoils of Yericho. Later on in Armasechta and the sixth Perek, we're going to deal with that whole story very extensively. But the point is, so what happens? So Ochan takes some of the spoils of Yericho. Yoshua doesn't know it at the time. Mm-hmm. Then they go then to the next battle against the city of Ai, and they lose it, and people are killed. And Yeshua and everybody are very frantic about it. And then, so by Yomer Hashem or Yeshua, Kum Loch, so Hashem says to Yeshua, get up. Lomazat and Nofal al Panacha, why are you falling on your face? Chota Yisrael, the Jewish people have sinned. Now, Omer Lefanav, now at this point, this is not in the Pasuk, this is the Gemara interjecting. Omer Lefanav, Ribbono Shel Olam, Michota, you're telling me the Jewish people sinned. Who was it specifically? Omer Lo, Hashem says, do you think I'm a Baal Lashon Hara? A dilator is it comes from a Latin word that means like a Baal Lashon Hara, like a professional informer. Do you think I'm that kind of person? Like Hato Gairolis, go make a girdle and you'll find out who the guilty party is. So we see that Hashem is, so to speak, covering for Achan and not telling him outright who was the Chote. But he's including the whole Jewish people. He's saying Chote Yisrael rather than singling out and saying Chote Pliny. The boy same I mean Moshe. Another possibility is we can also learn it from a story from Moshe Rabbeinu. Dichtiv ad ona me'antem. So what do we have after the mon was falling? Now Moshe had told them there's not going to be any mon on Shabbos. There's going to be a double portion on Friday, which is why we have Lechem Mishnah for Shabbos. So now the pasuk says on Shabbos some people, as we know, were Dosan and Aviram and their hangers on, went out to gather mon. They didn't find any. By the way, you know, it says in the Medrash, the birds ate up, they spread out mon before Shabbos, and the birds came and ate it, which is one reason why we feed the birds before Shabbos Sheder, in gratitude for them. Anyway, so then the Eibishter tells Moshe, ad onam me'antem, how long are you going to refuse to, are you, plural, going to refuse to listen to me? Now, it's not everybody, it's only Niftasam, only Minham, but Hashem is, so to speak, including Moshe, and saying you're all at fault. So again, like Hashem is not going to single out the ones who did wrong, he's going to say generically against everybody. So therefore, so another possibility then is that Shania learned from Moshe Rabbeinu in that. Now, so here's the question then. Again, why does each generation, why do we have to say, for example, that a mayor learned that Abchia learns from a mayor, and a mayor learns from Shmuel HaKatan, and so forth? Why can't we just have, they all know what it says in the Torah, on a mayantem, they all know what it says by Yeshua, Lomazat and Nofel HaPanacha, Chata Yisrael, why can't they just learn from that, instead of each one learning from the previous generation? And also, a related question is that in these last two cases with Moshe and with Yoshua, it's not really in order to not embarrass the ones, because after all, with Achan, we're going to find out, at least with Achan, there's going to be a girdle, we're going to find out who the guilty party is. As opposed to in all the other ones, for example, with a mayor and the guy who was Mekadosh Rabia, we never do find out who was the guy who did it. With Rav Chia, we never do find out who was the one who ate garlic, and so on and so forth. So it's not exactly the same thing anyway. So Marshall explains like this. Let's start with Shania ben Yechiel. It's also not really the same thing. He doesn't really embarrass himself personally. He says anachnu. He says all of us without specifying who the guilty parties are. So he's not really embarrassing himself either. So it's like this. With Rav Chia, it had really bad effects, because the result was, because he left, everybody left, and the result is the Shia was disrupted. So the question is, where did Rav Chia learn that you can go ab kadei kach to even be mevatel Torah for such a thing? So we can't learn that from Shechaniah or from Yeshua or from Moshe, because there it's not the same kind of thing. Therefore, Marshall says, so he has to answer, that so he has to answer from a mayor where, okay, you didn't have the takana yet that you give Malkus to somebody with Makadosh Bebiya, but nevertheless, it was already known to be a pritzesdika thing. So therefore, so he can learn at least from that, that at least somebody did something wrong, and therefore you cover up for him, just like this person did something wrong by eating garlic before Rebbe's shir. So therefore, he can only learn from a mayor, because at least you have, it's at least a little bit similar in that somebody did something wrong. Then you have Reb Meir has to learn from Shmuel HaKatan, where it's even less wrong, because after all, Shmuel HaKatan, whoever it was that came, also did something wrong without becoming, without being invited, but nevertheless, it's still not nearly as bad as being Mekadosh Bebiya, which is a pritzesdika thing. So therefore, Reb Meir can only learn from Shmuel HaKatan. He can't learn from anybody before him, because it's not the same kind of thing. And then we can learn from that, though, at least we can learn from that, that you don't want to reveal that somebody did something wrong, even though he deserves it. So therefore, that we learn, so that we can learn from Shechaniah and so forth, and we can go back through the rest of the chain. So that's how Marshal explains it. Marshal explains further. He says like this: when it comes to each one is following his own svara, each one is figuring in his own time what we need to do. Misvara de nafshe, he comes up with his own independent svara, or we could rather say, we could think that each of them came up with his own independent svara. But what it is like this. But you could look at it the other way around, with the story of Reb Chiya. Maybe he shouldn't do that after all, because, let's start from Yeshua, for example. Hashem tells him Chote Yisrael, or Moshe. So Shechaniah ben Yechiyo can learn from that, that because Hashem is going to call people sinners, even where they really weren't, just in order to avoid saying Lashon Hara about them, then therefore he can learn that a person should consider himself a Chote, and it's worth including him with himself, with the Chote, in order not to embarrass somebody else. Therefore he can say, Anachnu Ba'alnu Be'elekenu. Then, in that case, each one is learning from the one before him. So Shmuel HaKatan can learn from Shechaniah. Shechaniah could have done the other way around. He could have said that it's not right. Fine, Hashem is saying, I'm not going to tell who the guilty party is. That doesn't mean that I shouldn't do that. It still doesn't mean that I have to include myself among the sinners. We don't find Hashem saying that to Moshe, or Moshe saying that to Yeshua. But Shechaniah came up with that svara on his own, that it's worthwhile to say that I am one of the sinners, rather than embarrass somebody else. So Shmuel HaKatan learns from that, Davka from him, to say that therefore I should say I'm the guilty party in order to cover up for the other person who was the guilty party. In the same way, the mayor can learn only from Shmuel HaKatan and so forth. Each one can learn because in each case, you could argue do the other way around. With Shechaniah, he could have done the way he did, say I'm one of the guilty people, or he could have said not. With the next one after him, with the mayor, he could have said I'm the guilty party and I'll give you a get and so will everybody else. Or he could have said, you know what, we got to find out who did such thing, and then make sure he doesn't do it again. And the same thing with Shmuel HaKatan, and the same thing with each other generation. Therefore, each one has to learn Davka from the one before him, because with each one, there's a reason to say that they should have actually done the other way around. So that's another reason then why each of them needs to learn from the previous one. There's a musu dikavort on that. First of all, that when a person is figuring out how to act, he shouldn't just base it on his own svara. He should base it on something that he learned from his Rebbe, and it should be a Rebbe with whom he has a relationship. So therefore, the priya has to doctor learn from a mayor whom he apparently still had a chance to see, or at least it's close enough to his times. And Reb Meir has to learn from Shmuel HaKatan, who maybe didn't live in his times, but at least lived close to him, so that there can be a certain relationship between them, and so forth, rather than, let's say, going all the way back to Moshe or Yeshua, where we don't really have a direct relationship enough with them to be able to say, we can use what they did as a precedent for ourselves, because you're not necessarily learning the precedent correctly. So therefore, you need it from somebody closer to your time to be able to learn the precedent from.
Gave a get. She didn't come saying, I want a get. She just wanted to know who she was married.
She wanted to know who she was married. That's a pastor. The idea was, in other words, that she's saying that she's not necessarily saying, I want to go through this marriage. Apparently, the implication is that she wants out of it. I regret that I did that. And you know what? I want to find somebody who will be Makadosh me properly. That seems to be the implication.
Or could just be
if she wanted to continue with the marriage, then she would have told her mayor. So I guess the fact that everybody's writing her a get indicates that she just wanted, yeah. Okay. Fine. Speaking of Shmuel HaKatan, the Gemara tells a little bit more about him. Tana Rabbanan, Mishemesu Neviim Achronim Chagas Chaya Malachi. After the last of the Neviim, Chagas Chaya Malachi, passed away near the beginning of the second Mishmikdash, Nistalka Ruach HaKodesh Mi Yisrael. Ruach HaKodesh of Nevuah left the Jewish people.
There wasn't one big tally who was lived by the second base.
What? At the beginning of the second base mitzvah, she still had Chagas Chayi Malachi, but then that's it.
But no one else stayed
alive. What do you mean no one else stayed alive?
I'm talking about
the Nevi'im.
Who were very, very big standard by the second base mitzvah.
That's just Nesek Dola, knew, but then you had the...
There wasn't one person.
No.
Just one.
Okay.
Rebbe was by the first base?
Rebbe is after the second base mitzvah was destroyed. We're talking about Nevuah. Rebbe didn't have Nevuah. Talking Nevi'im. Chagas Chayi Malachi were the last Nevi'im. The Afrikan Hoy Mishkamshim Baskel. Nevertheless, they continue to use a Baskel. There would be a voice that they hear where from Shemayim that tells them something that they didn't otherwise know. Tosfos explains that one reason why it's called Baskel, Bas literally means the daughter of. So it means like an echo of a voice. So like you have a voice from Shemayim, and then you have like all you're hearing is an echo of that voice.
How does that answer?
The point is, no, it's not Nevuah anymore.
But I'm saying they can understand
it. And they can understand it, yeah. But there's a few other explanations why we call it a bas kol. One is that bas also means a measure, so it's like a certain measured, limited amount of voice from Hashem. Whatever. Anyway. One time the Chachamim were reclining and having a meal in the second floor of Beis Guria in Yericho. Here also we see that the second floor was like a main dining room. And then all of a sudden they heard a voice, they heard a baskel from Shemayim. Yesh kan echad sheroi shetisha olav shchina kemosh Rabbeinu. There's one person here who would be worthy that the shchina should rest on him like Moshe Rabbeinu. Ela she'en derde zakei lakach. But his generation is not worthy of it, and therefore he's not able to have nevuah. Who is that? Nosna Chacham Mesenem, the Hillel Hazaken. The Chacham gave a look over to Hillel. They realized he must be the one that the baskel is referring to. The words Kemosh Rabbeinu are in parenthesis over here because the Marshal takes them out. Loi kom Novi oi bistro Kemoshe, it says in the Pasuk. There was never a Novi again like Moshe. So how could you say he would have had Nevuah like Moshe? On the other hand, the Rambam does have that gear set, and the Rambam says, okay, it doesn't literally mean like Moshe. It means to the extent that a person could be similar to Moshe.
Marshal, a little change will make a difference.
Yeah, Marshal points out also there is a similarity between them. Both Hillel and Moshe lived 120 years, and both of them led the Jewish people for the last 40 years of their lives. Oh. So yeah. When Hillel Hazaken passed away, Omru Olav, they said a hesped on him, Hey Chosid, Hey Onav, where is the Chosid, where is the humble one, Talmidei Shel Ezra, the Talmud of Ezra. So they're calling Hillel, now Hillel lived a couple hundred years after Ezra, they're calling him his Talmud. Marsha explains there's a similarity between them. Both of them came from Babel and reestablished knowledge of Torah in Eretz Yisrael when it was being forgotten in Eretz Yisrael. Ezra at the beginning of the second Beis Hamikdash, and Hillel in his times, towards the end of 100 years before the second Beis Hamikdash was destroyed. Both times they were having very hard times of it in Eretz Yisrael, and the Torah was being forgotten, and Ezra in his times and Hillel in his times came and reinforced and reestablished the knowledge of the Torah, and therefore Hillel can be called a Talmud of Ezra in that sense. Then the Braisa continues. Shuv pam achas hoy mesubin ba'aliyah b'yavne. Another time the Chachamim were reclining and having a meal, having a banquet in a second floor of a house in Yavne. And again, they heard a baskel from Shemayim. Yeshkan echad shadroi shetishol of Shchina. There's one person among you who's worthy that the Shchina should rest on him. Elisha in dirt is zaka lakach, but his generation is not worthy of it. And the point is, in other words, that for a person to have Nevuah, it's not enough that he himself is of the caliber of it. It has to be that his generation is of the caliber to have Nevi'im among them. So these baskels, both times, are saying that's how it is. Nosna Chum is the name of Shmuel HaKotten. The Chum looked over at Shmuel HaKotten, realizing that he's the one that the baskel is referring to.
He's
called Shmuel HaKotten, so there's a couple of explanations. One reason is, yeah, because he was very humble. Another very interesting explanation is actually that he's called Shmuel HaKotten to indicate he's almost at the level of Shmuel HaNavi. But he's Kotten, he's a little less than that. Yeah. Anyway. And when he passed away, also they said a similar hesped on him. Omru Olam, they said, Hey Chosid, Hey Onav, where is the Chosid, where is the humble one? Talmidei Shel Hillel. He's the Talmud of Hillel. Now Marsha points out, here they didn't call him the Talmud of Ezra, or here they didn't call him the Talmud because he's not like Ezra, but they also, the Baskel didn't say that he's worthy, that the Shchina should last on him, should rest on him like Moshe Rabbeinu, because unlike Moshe Rabbeinu and unlike Hillel, Shmuel HaKotten didn't lead the Jewish people for 40 years. So there isn't that similarity, but nevertheless, yeah. Okay. And the Gemara mentions, by the way, something else about Shmuel HaKotten.
Talking about Moshe Rabbeinu, the generation of Moshe Rabbeinu were probably less deserving than the one of Shmuel HaKotten.
No, on the contrary. The very fact that the Baskel was saying that in Moshe's times they were worthy of
the Shmuel HaKotten. I know, but where is the Bat Kol saying that? I mean, Hashem said that it's a generation of hard necks.
That's true, but nevertheless, they were, after all, the generation who received the Torah. They were the generation, they're called Dor Dea, they're the generation of knowledge. They're unsurpassed, really, among future generations of the Jewish people. When the Torah criticizes them over and over, it's relative to what they could have been. But nevertheless, still, they were on, let's put it this way, one reason it's brought in Sfarim, why Taka did Hashem eventually take away Nevuah from the Jewish people? Because we find, towards the end of the second Beis Hamikdash, towards the end of the first Beis Hamikdash, I mean, we find that sometimes they weren't listening to the Nevi'im, but they're actually trying to kill them. So there comes a point when Hashem says, you know what, you obviously don't appreciate Nevuah, I can't have you have it anymore. In Moshe Rabbeinu's times, as much as they harassed him and everything, here when Moshe, for example, at one point says, Oid ma'atu skoluni, I feel like they're about to stone me, Hashem tells him, no, go in front of the people, see if anybody of you any day will pick up a stone against you. Lama Zerashi says at the end of Parashas B'Shalach, Lama Zata Moitzi La'az Abonai, what are you talking Lashon Hara? What are you talking badly against the Jewish people? They wouldn't do such a thing. So we see that in the times of Moshe, as much as they caused him tzaras, they never would go to that extreme, whereas later in the time of the first Beis Hamikdash, we find they did. And apparently the idea is, the Bas Kol is saying that yes, in the times of Hillel and the times of Shmuel HaKotan, yes, there would actually be people who would have the chutzpah to do that had there been Nevi'im. So yeah, as much as we think that, we think that the generations in the times of Chumash and the times of Rest of Tanakh weren't so great because the Psukim focus on their faults. Very little do the Psukim focus on the good that they did. But the fact is, we have to read between the lines and realize what tremendous people they were relative to any later generation.
Why the Psukim focuses on their faults when they were so great then?
For one thing, because the Torah wants us to learn from their, to learn not to repeat their faults. Once the Torah tells us that they have a certain mitzvah, then it's almost like a given. Yes, of course, they're going to be doing that mitzvah. It doesn't have to tell us that they did that mitzvah. But therefore, in the later books of Tanakh, you have very little mention, for example, of the mitzvahs that they did. It's only, it mentions it incidentally once in a while, but it's not the focus. Because once we know a mitzvah is given, of course, they're going to do it. When they didn't act the way they're supposed to, it's like that's a chidush, and that's something that has to be reported and something that we should know to learn from them. But I want to tell you also, I mean, I don't want to get too far off because we have a lot of ground to cover still, but you should know, the Gemara tells us in Yoma, for example, that consider the generations of the first Beis Hamikdash, as bad as we think they were, nevertheless, they had the schus, some of them at least, survived to see the second Beis Hamikdash. Not one person who was alive at the time of the second Beis Hamikdash is still around now to see the third Beis Hamikdash when it comes. There'll be Tchias and Basin, but nevertheless, we see that those earlier generations were far, far greater in Ruchnius than the later generations. Because we see that the Beis Hamikdash returned shortly after the first one, but not after the second one.
When we learned that even the kids knew the Sefer Torah.
That was in the times of Chizkiyahu primarily, yeah.
Which is
that's the first Beis Hamikdash. It's 100 odd years before the Horban, yeah. Yeah. Anyway, So the Gemara continues, V'afhu Omer B'shas Misase. Here's something else you should know about Shmuel HaKotan, to give you an idea of his Ruach HaKodesh. Before he passed away, he said as follows, Shimon v'Yishmol l'charba. Shimon and Yishmol are going to be killed by the sword. Rashi says this refers to Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel and Rabbi Shmol ben Elisha, the Kohen Gadol. We know famously from the Piyutim that we say in Musaf of Yom Kippur, Eila Ezkira, and that we say on Tisha B'Av, Arzeh Halavonin. We know that they were the first two of the Asura Aruge Malchus. So he's predicting many years in advance that this is going to happen. This is Rabbi Shimon, Shmuel HaKotan we're talking about. Shmuel HaKotan. Now, there are different opinions. It's not clear from the Gemara when Shmuel HaKotan passed away. Some say he passed away before the Churban, and that Rabbi Shimon Gamliel and Rabbi Shmuel were killed at the time of the Churban. Others say that he outlived the Churban, and therefore he's talking about what happened at the time of the War of Bar Kochba. Either way, he's saying it many years in advance before it happened. This is Ruach HaKodesh, Bashar, that he had. So he says, Shimon v'Yishmol l'charba, v'chavroi l'ktala, their colleagues, the rest of the Asur Arugim Malchus, are going to be killed in various ways. And as Marshal explains, the difference between the wording is Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Shmuel were killed, so to speak, in a more honorable way. They were killed by the sword. Even among the Goyim, that's considered like a way that you kill aristocrats, like important people, as opposed to common people are killed with various other more gruesome ways. So Shimon and Yishmael, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel and Rabbi Shmuel Kohen Gadol, were at least killed, as much as it was a terrible thing that they were killed, at least the Romans had a little derech eretz for them and in keeping with their position and killed them with the sword, as opposed to all the other Asura Rugamalfas were killed in terrible, torturous, gruesome ways, but that's what it means over here, the Ktala. And he continues, Ashor Amal Viza, the rest of the people are going to be plundered by the Goyim, Va'okan Sagian Asidim Amesal Alma, and many terrible troubles are going to come on the world. So if he passed away before Churban Bayis Sheni, then he's referring to all the events surrounding the Churban, all the terrible tragedies that happened then. If he outlived the Churban, and then he's talking about the war of Bar Kokhba, where also it was a horrible time for the Jewish people. We have a lot of the Sugya in Gittin that talks about the Churban. You have a whole piece over there that talks about what happened after the war of Bar Kokhba and the destruction of Beta and all of that, so then it would mean that he's predicting that. And the Gemara continues, Va'al Yehuda ben Bava, Bitruloi Makain. Now eventually, Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava, when he passed away, and we're going to have later on in the parashah the story of how he was also one of the Asura Aruga Malchus, the whole story where he gave smicha to five or six of the Chachamim, and then the Romans pierced him with hundreds of iron spears. Yeah, we're going to have later on Daf Yudalad, we're going to have the story. So when he passed away also, Bikshu Loi Makain, they also wanted to say the same kind of hesped on him. Hey Chosid, hey Onav, where is the Chosid, where is the Onav? Ella Shenitrafa Shah, but the time was confused, they weren't able to, She'in Maspid in Aharugi Malchus, you don't make a hesped for those who are killed by the government. Now why not? There's a number of reasons that are given. The Yad Ramah brings a couple of reasons why not. One of them is because Poshik, you need to bury him as fast as possible before the Romans or whichever government are going to prevent you from burying him. So therefore, they don't have time for a spadium. They got to get the burial taken care of as soon as possible.
But they don't want to be buried?
What?
They don't want to...
Many times, if somebody's killed by the government, they wouldn't necessarily. With Rabbi Akiva, for example, we find that his body was in the jail cell over there, and Eliyahu had to come together with one of Rabbi Akiva's talmidim to get the body out of there to have it buried. We know, for example, Maharam Rutenberg was kept in jail for ransom, and even after he passed away, the emperor wouldn't allow them to release the body. 14 years, and Maharam's body lay over there in the cell over there in the castle of Ensisheim until finally, a rich yid paid money to have the body taken out and brought to burial. He only asked, by the way, for his schar, that he should be buried next to Maharam Rutenberg. And Adar Yemazeh, you have in the old Beis HaKvaris in Worms, in Vermeise in Germany, you have a double maseva over there, one for the Maharam and one for the Siyid Rabziskin,
Where was that in the time?
So the Maharam himself lived in Germany. His hometown where he taught was Rothenburg in Germany, which is why he's called Maharam Rutenberg. When he was arrested, he was put in a castle in Ensisheim, which is in Alsace and in Western Germany, or maybe nowadays Eastern
it's
France.
It's in Alsace.
What? Yeah, it's in Alsace.
It's in Alsace.
For a reason.
What?
Why was he arrested?
So he was arrested because he was trying to leave Germany, because at that time the German emperors were being, they figured the Jews are basically a source of, we're going to use them to squeeze out as much money as they can from them in taxes and whatnot. So the Maharam decides it's not worth staying in Germany anymore. He wants to leave. He wants to go to Eretz Yisrael and be out of that, and maybe other Yidden from Germany will follow his example as well. Unfortunately, a Meshumad recognized him when he was on the road and went and informed the emperor, and they realized exactly that. If the Maharam leaves, everybody's going to leave, and we're losing our Jews who we can fleece for money. So therefore, so they arrested him and put him in this castle over there in Ensisheim, where the deal was, the famous story is that the emperor demanded an enormous ransom for the Maharam. They were gathering together all the money.
He doesn't want to.
And then when the Maharam found out about it, he said, absolutely not. As the commissioner tells us in Masechta Gittin, you don't redeem, you're not poida shvuyim for more than they're worth, because you don't want to encourage the goyim to do this again and again. So he ended up staying there for the next 7 years until he was nifter, and then afterwards, as I said, his body was there another 14 years. Yeah. And by the way, his refusal worked. The German emperors never tried this kind of thing again, because they realized it didn't work with the Maharam. It's not going to work. So Taka helped that future Rabbanim was spared from that kind of thing. But yeah.
He paid the price.
Yes.
Which year was that?
So he was arrested in the year 1286, Heyalof and Memvov. He was nifter 7 years later in 1293. And then when they finally were able to ransom the Maharam's body and bring it to burial in Worms, it was in the year 1307. Anyway, the point is, so the Yad Ramah says one point over here, why we don't make a hesped for Harugi Malchus, like Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava, is partially because we need to get them buried as fast as possible before the Romans or whoever it is don't allow the burial to happen. Then he says a couple of other reasons. Another reason is, Because the government doesn't really, is going to be mocked on it. What do you mean? We killed the guy as a criminal. That's their way of thinking. How are you talking? You're honoring him and making a hesped for him. It could get more Jews in trouble. Especially on top of that, he says the king is going to say that the ones who are making the hesped are his friends. They're his collaborators and whatnot. And then they could be in danger as well. The Ben Yehoyada goes further. He says also the Goyim might start making a bilbil. They might start making up a story that during the Hespedim they were cursing out the king and the emperor and the government and whatnot. So for all those reasons they couldn't say this Hesped for Rabbi Yehuda ben Vava. Later on in the Masechta, by the way, we're going to talk about even in the Shuls, the Pashas, they had spies. You think of the Shuls in Russia during the times of the Soviet Union. You always have KGB spies over there. So here, probably it was the same kind of thing.
Yeah, but they don't speak about him. They wouldn't speak about the Romans.
Yeah, but nevertheless, they could always make a story out of it. Yeah. But I was going to say later on in the Masechta, we're actually going to talk about the point that when you have a person has not been zoichah to burial, or a person was not zoichah to a hesped, it can be a schus for his neshama that he didn't have that covered, that he had that bizoyan instead to not be properly buried and to not be properly nisbat itself is a certain kapara for him. So in the case of Rabbi Yehuda ben Vava being one of Asor Harugim Malchus, he doesn't really need that kapara, but nevertheless, yeah. In one of the kinnis, we say on Tisha B'Av, we say the expression, we're talking about people who were killed, Al Kiddush Hashem in the Crusades or whatever, there's an expression over there, Simen Toiv La'odim Shla Nisbad V'Nikba Ka'alocha. It's a good simen for a person. Sometimes we need to have a proper hesped, and we need to have a proper burial, as we have over here. Anyway, getting back to the Gemara. Okay, so that was a digression to talk about Shmuel HaKotin. Now let's get back to the dinim of declaring an ibul yer. Let's talk about the factors. Let's talk about the procedure for declaring an ibul yer. Tana Rabbanan, ein ma'aber nesashana elein kin yirtzen nasi. We can only declare an ibul yer only if the nasi agrees. So like we had at the top of the amud, the nasi was one of the seven, so it has to be at least, even if the nasi is not going to be one of the seven, at least he has to agree that they're going to make a leap year. U'maisa b'ram gamliel shaholach lito rishus eitzel shilten echad shebasuria. It happened once that Rav Gamliel had to go and get rishus from a minister, from a government minister in Syria. Now Rashi explains, little rishus doesn't mean to get rishus as in to get permission. Why would the goy care about whether they make a leap year? So Rashi explains the dabra al iski tzibur. Rav Gamliel had to deal with the Roman governor over there in Syria concerning matters involving the tzibur. Historically, we know that during the time of Rav Gamliel was nasi a few decades before the Churban, we know that there were always troubles over there between the Romans who ruled over Eretz Yisrael and the local Roman governors a lot of times were anti-Semitic and whatever. So at one point, it seems that Rav Gamliel went to talk to the governor of Syria, who officially is in charge of the procurator at Eretz Yisrael, to get him to tell the guy to back off or whatever. So that would be a case where Rav Gamliel traveled to Syria for that purpose.
They respected him also.
They respected him, Pasha. Yeah, so this way he could go there and he could tell the governor, listen, you have your subordinate, your guy who reports to you, who's our ruler in Eretz Yisrael, and he's harassing us for no good reason. Tell him to back off. And then, yeah, so you have, yeah. So it could have been that. On the other hand, there are Mephoshim who explain, I think the Yad Ramah explains, that in fact it could mean Rishus in the sense that after all, there's a tax year, there's a tax season or whatever, and if they declare a leap year, it's going to affect when the crops are harvested, and it's going to affect all kinds of things like that. So therefore, he would have to get, so to speak, official permission from the Roman governor for them to be able to declare a leap year. So he had gone to do that. The Shahalava, and he was delayed getting back. The Ibru Asashana, Manasri Yusuf Ram Gamliel. So they declared an Ibru Yer on condition that Ram Gamliel agrees. When Ram Gamliel comes back and he says, yes, I agree, Nimsis, Shonam Oberas, then the year turns out to be a leap year. So in other words, they don't need his permission in advance. They don't need his consent in advance, but they can do it al tnai that if he consents. And since in the end he consented, then it works out.
That's why he went. I mean, they don't.
So that's the thing. According to Rashi, when he went to talk to the Roman governor in Syria, had nothing to do with the Ibruyar per se. It had to do with the Tzorchei Tzibur that he needed to deal with. But by the way, that year they had to declare a leap year, and therefore they didn't have Ram Gamliel around to consult with, so they had to wait until he gets back and says that I agree with it. But in other words, otherwise they would have waited until he got back. But since it was getting late, and as we're going to learn tomorrow, Baz Hashem, they have a deadline by which they can declare an Ibur Yer, and therefore they had to do it this way. According to the Yad Ramah's explanation, the point was that Ram Gamliel, they couldn't declare an Ibur Yer without official permission from this Roman governor, otherwise it's going to mess up the tax season or whatever. But in any case, they had to wait. But obviously they're not going to say, depending on whether that Goyish governor says, they're going to say, depending on what Ram Gamliel says. Yeah. Anyway.
So it's going to be in the Gemara when we're going to learn?
We're going to learn tomorrow, Beis Hashem. We're going to continue with these Dinim of Eber. But
the second day of this or something?
Right, we're going to talk about Shchodesh, the 29th of Adar. We'll learn about it tomorrow. Hold on. What? 70? What is it? 70?
I remember what you
said. Oh, yeah, good. Okay, fine. Okay, onward. When do we make? We can only make an Ibur Yar only if the year needs it. And what do you mean needs it? For example, when they have drachim, one reason could be because the roads are still muddy. They got all muddy and messed up during the winter time from the rain, and now they haven't been fixed yet. So the Oile Regel aren't going to be able to make it to Yerushalayim. And because of the bridges that have gotten washed away and they have the same problem, they can't safely cross to get to Yerushalayim. Another reason would be because of the ovens that they make for roasting the Korban Pesach. They're made out of clay, and during the winter time they tend to fall apart because clay is a soft material. It doesn't survive the rains well. Even if it's fired, it's still, the ovens are usually outside the houses, and they don't necessarily get through the winter in such good shape. So the point is, they might not have enough time to repair them or to make new ones before Pesach, and therefore they would make an Ibur Yor. That would be a valid reason. Another reason would be because of Golis, because of Jews, because of groups of Jews who are coming from Chutz La'aretz, they started leaving, but they haven't arrived yet. So the ones in Eretz Yisrael, they don't have to worry about so much, Tosfos points out, because the whole Eretz Yisrael, they can easily, even if they leave Rosh Chodesh Nissan, they can get there by Pesach. The maximum it would take, generally, is about 2 weeks, as we find from other Gemaras. But if they're living in Chutz La'aretz, now in Chutz La'aretz, they're not required to come on Aliyah L'Regel in the first place. But if they come, then nevertheless, we want to take them into consideration, and we don't want them to miss Pesach. So therefore, we can make an Ibur Yor because of that.
And you know they come.
What? They could know, because let's say, for example, you think about a whole crowd of people with their korbanos and all is going to travel much slower than, for example, they could send somebody ahead of them to inform that to inform. They could probably send fire signals or smoke signals or whatever. Yeah, they have ways of getting the news ahead of them. Avaloy mepnei shelig, but it's not a valid reason to make an Ibur Yor because it's snowy. Veloy mepnei tsina, or because it's cold, because that won't prevent people from being oda l'regel. Veloy mepnei golis yisrael, shaloy okru memekoyman, and not because of Jews from Chutz La'aretz that have not yet left their place. Meaning, as the Torah Chaim says, even if. They've informed, we plan to leave, but they haven't actually left yet. What Beis Din is sitting down to do their deliberations, that's not a valid reason to make an Ibur Yor for their sake, because they haven't actually left yet. When they leave, then fine. If we know they already left, then that's a valid reason to declare an Ibur Yor. So the Gemara continues. Another Braisa. Other reasons, other factors that we might think to consider, which we cannot in fact use as factors to declare a leap year, is because, as we were touching on before, is because of the young goats or the young sheep, meaning they're still little. We don't want to make, the fact is, you could bring them when they're little. As long as they're at least 8 days old, you can bring them as a korban. So it's not a valid reason to say, yeah, but they're still little, and you're not going to have much meat on them for each korban Pesach. That's not a valid reason to declare a leap year. And also not because of the young birds that are not flying yet. Now, people are going to need birds for their korbanos. Women who gave birth, zavim, zavos, all of them, they're not going to bring their korbanos throughout the year because they're schlep to get to Yerushalayim. They're going to wait till the Oile L'Regel anyway, and then they're going to bring their korbanos with them so they can be tahor in time to eat the korban Pesach. But that's not a valid reason, because Rashi explains, after all, they could bring Bnei Yona. There are two kinds of birds that are kosher as korbanos, Torim and Bnei Yona. Torim are turtle doves, Bnei Yona are common doves, and Bnei Yona are kosher even when they're babies. As long as they're more than a week or two old, it is not, unlike with animals, you don't have a specific 8-day thing. It has to be old enough, I think, that you pull out a feather and blood will come out. But the point is, in other words, they only have to be a few days, or at most a few weeks old, and they'll be, even if they're tiny, you'll still be able to bring them as korbanos. So the fact that they're tiny is not a valid reason to add a second adder. Aval, Oisin, Oisin, Sab, Lashana. However, we can make those things as a secondary reason to make an Ibriyar, like to help out, in other words, to make, like, it actually says, Siag v'smach l'divreim. We can use it as like a
fence,
like to help build the case. In other words, later on, the Gemara is going to explain that there are three primary factors that we take into consideration whether to make an Ibriyar. Now, generally, if we have two or more of them, then we definitely make a leap year. But what if we only have one of them? Then we can use these as a secondary factor to help support the idea to make a leap year. That's how Rashi learns. The Rambam learns that when we say Sad Lashana, doesn't mean that we factor them in at all. It just means, as the Gemara is going to go on to say now, when they're sending out the letters to inform everybody that there's going to be a leap year, we mention these points as well. Just so people should understand, we had good reasons to declare a leap year, but not that the Sanhedrin themselves will actually factor those in their deliberations. There's an interesting point, actually, from J.B. Soloveitchik, Olav HaShalom, who says in one of his shiurim that we always think the Sanhedrin has the power, and that's it. Everybody has to listen to them, no questions asked. But sometimes we find that the Sanhedrin, when they make a gzeira, for example, we find famously, ein goizum gzeira al tzibur, elen kin yorev al tzibur yichon lamed ba. When the Sanhedrin makes a gzeira, they have to make sure most of the Jewish people are going to be able to follow it. And if not, it's not a valid gzeira. So he says it may be similarly over here with a leap year. If Dastin were to declare a leap year, but most of the people don't buy into that, it wouldn't be a valid leap year. Therefore, he says that's why they may need the sad, lashana. It might be, in other words, people are going to say, what tikufa? I don't know from no tikufa. I know that I want Pesach to be ready. I want it to, you know, I'm preparing to go on a Lila Regal. I have all my plans and everything. I don't want to get messed up with an extra month. So you tell them just because of the tikufa, or because, as the Gemara is going to say, the crops are not completely ripe yet. Yeah, maybe, maybe not. But you tell them something that they can understand as farmers. For example, that the baby lambs and baby goats are still too little. Oh, that we can understand. Fine. We can understand they had a reason to make a leap here. So that would be why they'd mention this point in their letters, even though they're not actually using it, according to the Rambam, in deliberating whether to make a leap year. Okay. So Kesad, what do we mean to make it a sad Lashana? Rabbi Yana, Omer B'Shim Shimon Gamliel. So Rabbi Yana quotes in the name of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel the Nusach that they would send in a letter. The letters would be in Aramaic, because that was what most Jews spoke during the time of the Second Beis Hamikdash. So they wrote, Mahoidein anachna l'choin, we are informing you, the gozlaya rakichin, that the baby birds are still little, the imraya da'arkin, or da'adkin, really it's supposed to be, and the lambs are still very thin and small, the zimna da'aviva le'mata, and the time of Aviv, the time of the spring equinox has not yet come, u'shvaras milsa ba'anpoi, and so the matter was good in my eyes, this is the Nossi writing, the letter is written in the name of the Nossi, v'oisifas al-shatadot slosin yoimin, and so we've added 30 days to this year. So that was the nusach that they would write. So we see, for example, they would mention the fact that the Aviv, that the spring has not come, and which is one of the main simonim. However, they would also use the fact that the birds and the lambs and the whatnot are little. They'd use that as a secondary reason when they're mentioning it to the people. So the Gemara says, wait, now, at the end of the Nusach, they're saying that they're adding 30 days. But mostly, I have a contradiction. A Braisa says, Kama Ibrashana Shloshim Yoim, when we make an extra Adar, how many days is the extra Adar? 30 days. Reb Shimon Gamliel Oim a Chodesh. And Reb Shimon Gamliel says a Chodesh, which usually a Chodesh means 29 days. So you were quoting Reb Shimon Gamliel saying Chodesh, that he would write in the Nusach of his letters, he would write Shloshim Yoim, Tlosin Yoim, which is 30 days, but he himself is saying in the Braisa, Chodesh.
Makes a difference one day.
Makes a difference. I mean, one day is one day. Amar Papa, Rotsu Chodesh, Rotsu Shloshim Yoim. The answer is it could be either way. They could write whatever Nusach they want. Because the point is, Mephoshim explained, the Bnei HaGoyla, these letters are being sent to Jews throughout the world. Now, they know, of course, that the length of the Chodesh Iver is not predetermined, because it's going to depend. When is the Molad going to be the next month? And are Edom going to show up? So when they write a nusach to them, 29 or 30 days, the Bnei HaGoyla know, we can't rely on that necessarily anyway. We know it's going to be whatever, we're going to know. There's going to be an uncertainty with Rosh Chodesh, as there always is, which is why we have 2 days Yom with most Yom Tovim. So therefore, the Sanhedrin can write, the Nasi can write whatever nusach he wants, and either way, everybody understands it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be 29 days. It doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be 30 days. It all depends what's the story with the Edom next month. Now, the Gemara points out, now you have in this Nusach, Rav Shimon Gamliel is saying that I decided it was good in my eyes, and so I added 30 days to the month. So he's only mentioning himself, not the other members of the Sanhedrin. So the Gemara points out, Tochazi, come see the difference. My Ika ben Takife Kadmoi Litin Vasani Basroi. Come see the difference between the Udiu generations who were much tougher, namely Rav Gamliel, Litin Vasani Basroi, versus the later ones who were more humble. Like this, we have Rav Gamliel, Rav Gamliel the Yavne, the famous Rav Gamliel throughout Shas. He's the one who acted in a very high-handed way against Rabbi Yeshua in the whole story of Tfilas Arvis Rishus, where he made Rabbi Yeshua stay standing. Yeah, the whole question over there whether Tfilas Arvis is Rishus or Choyva, and Rav Gamliel, Rabbi Yeshua had said that it's Rishus, and Rav Gamliel had said it's Choyva, and then in the Bismedrish, Rav Gamliel made a public spectacle of it and publicly humiliated Rabbi Yeshua and made him stay standing, and everybody got angry, and that's why they deposed Rav Gamliel and appointed Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah as Nasi. So you have that whole story. So Rav Gamliel is a Takifi Kadmoi. He's the Udiu generation who were the tougher ones. He acted in a very tough way. And then versus in the Soi Basroi, versus we find him, Shimon Gamliel was famous for his anivus. The in Bava Metzia, you have the story. We learned it when we were learning Bava Metzia last year. That at one point, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says about himself, compared to Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai, he's like a lion and I'm like a fox. And the Gemara says he was one of the great anovim in Jewish history for saying such a thing. He's the Nasi, and he's putting himself down compared to one of the other Chachamim. And yet, we find that Rav Gamliel, as the Gemara is going to quote now, when he gave his letter out about leap years in his times, he wrote it in a way that acknowledges his colleagues, his chaverim as well, whereas Rav Shimon Gamliel does not. He just writes, Ban Pori in my eyes. So we see the difference, that even though Rav Gamliel acted in a very... seemingly in a way like I'm showing who's boss, nevertheless, when it came to writing his letters, he wrote them in a more anivustic way. Whereas Rav Shimon Gamliel, who was famous for his anivus, but when he writes his letters, he's writing them as I'm saying. So the Gemara is pointing out that contrast. D'tanya, we learn in a b'risa. Maisa, but Rav Gamliel show you Yosef Agav Maila b'Harabayis. It happened once that Rav Gamliel was sitting on a step on the Harabayis, so when the second best message was still standing with Ashras. Yochanan, this sofer was standing, he was Rav Gamliel's scribe, he was taking letters for him, was standing in front of him. The Sholosh Igris Chatuchos Lefonov, and Yochanan had in front of him three cut sheets of paper, or parchment, or whatever, three blanks ready to write letters on, whatever Rav Gamliel is going to dictate to him. You know, you think of the Rebbe with the Maskiros in the old days, you know, this Yochanan is the Maskiros and Rav Gamliel is the Rebbe. So he's going to dictate him a letter, and he's gonna write it out. Omoloi, the first Rav Gamliel tells him, Tol Igra Techoda, take one blank, Uchtoiv, and write the following. La'achona b'nei Grila Ila, to our brothers, the people of the upper Galil, which is like the area around Sfas and Sipori and whatever, the mountainous areas of the Galil in the north of Eretz Yisrael, V'lachona b'nei Grilot HaTatar, and to our brothers in the lower Galil, which is like the area of Tveria and the other low-lying areas of that part of Eretz Yisrael, Shloimcha Yiske, may your peace increase, although a loshen of bracha to them, Mahoide Nanachna L'choin, we are hereby informing you, Tizman bi'ura mata, that the time of bi'ur maestris has come. Tizman bi'ura, the time of bi'ur mata has arrived. La'afrushi maestra mimatona dezesa. It's time to take maestra from your vats of olives. The Galil was famous for its olives. Even nowadays, they have a lot of olive trees growing there, but in those times, they had a lot more. So olives and olive oil were one of the main exports from that part of Eretz Yisrael. We know there's a concept of bi'ur maestris. The farmer doesn't always have to give his maestris right away. He can set them aside. He has to designate them so that the food is not tevel and he's able to eat them. But afterwards, he can store them in his olive press or his granary or whatever until it's time. It comes eventually after the third year and after the sixth year of Shemitah, during Pesach of the following year. Erev Pesach according to Rashi, Achron Shal Pesach according to the Rambam, he has to do Biur Maestris, he has to make sure that all the Maestris are given out to the respective parties. Truma to the Kohenim, Maestri Rishon to the Leviim, Maestri Oni to the Aniim, etc., etc. All of that has to be taken care of. And then he says the famous Vidui Maestris that we have in Parashas Kisavai, the Arti HaKodesh Min Abayis and that whole Nusach. So now Rav Gamliel is sending a letter to them that we hereby inform you that the time for Biur Maestris is coming, so make sure that you've taken care of all the Maestri, although the Trumas and Maestris and everything from your vat of olives and olive oil that you've been producing all these last few years. That was the first letter. The Toil Igata Choda. Then he says to Yochanan, take a second letter, take a second blank, Uchtoiv, and write on it. La'achona b'nei deroima, to our brothers in the south of Eretz Yisrael, which means the area of Yehuda, the southern area of Eretz Yisrael, the area of Yehuda, the area of Yerushalayim and Lud and Hebron and so on and so forth. Shloimchan Yiske, may your peace increase. Mohoyden anachna l'choin, we hereby inform you, Dizman bi'uramata, that again the time of beer is coming. La'afrushin maestra me umre shibalaya, that's time to take your maestra and give it out from your sheaves of grain. The south of Eretz Yisrael, they didn't focus so much on growing olives and olive oil. They specialized in growing grain. So therefore, he's informing them. You have your grain that you've grown and are storing away your trumas and maestras from the last couple of years. Now it's time to do beer maestras on it. So Tosfos points out, by the way, that when they're still in sheaves, they're not yet necessarily chayiv and maestro yet. Because Rabbi Akiva later on explained that if they haven't reached Oynas HaMaisers, if they haven't received the stage of processing when they're Chayiv and Maiser, when it comes the time of beer, then you don't have to do beer on them. Well, Rabbi Gamliel was before that, so that opinion of Rabbi Akiva was not yet the normative halacha, and therefore Rabbi Gamliel is talking according to the way it was before that, that even they haven't reached Oynas HaMaisers yet, nevertheless, you still have to take care of Maiser at this point. Anyway, the toil igur chada. Then Rabbi Gamliel continues to his secretary Yochanan. The toil igur chada. Then take a third letter. Uchtoiv la'achona bnei galvasa b'bavel, to our brothers, the people of the Golos in Bavel, the Lachon of Modai, and in Modai, which is nowadays part of Iran, or the Shalko Galvosa de Israel, and all the other Jews throughout the world in Golos, Shloimchan Yiske la'olam, may your peace increase forever. Mahodin anachna l'choin, we hereby inform you, the gozalaya rakichin, that the young birds are little, the imraya arkin, or adkin, daadkin, really it's supposed to be, and the young lambs are still little and thin, the zimna da'abiva loimasa, and the time of chodesh ha'aviv, the time of the spring has not yet come, or shvara milsaban poi, or va'anpe chavirai, and therefore the matter has been good in my sight, and in the sight of my colleagues, the other members of Sanhedrin, we've added 30 days to this year. So the point is, Rabbi Gamliel is using the expression that I and my colleagues, the other members of the Beis Din, have all agreed to make a leap year. Whereas in Rabbi Shimon Gamliel's letter that we quoted before, we said it was just I in my eyes. So we see that contrast. But the Gemara says maybe it's not such a contrast. Duma bosa da'abruhu. Because maybe the difference is, exactly, after Rabbi Gamliel went through that whole thing with being deposed and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah being appointed as the co-nasi together with him, so maybe now, therefore, maybe he became an onav, and now he's writing, now he's writing I and my colleagues. So maybe before that, he used to only write also I, but then after he went through all of that, then he started writing I and my colleagues. Tosfos explains it a little differently. Now that he has a colleague, he has Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah as his co-nasi. So therefore he has no choice but to write in my sight and in the sight of my chaverim, because he needs to explain that I'm not the only nasi anymore. Now there is a big question with all of this, though, namely Rav Gamliel de Yavne, the one with whom that whole story happened of being deposed, his nesius was after the Churban. So how is he sitting on a step in the Har HaBayis and giving instructions, and why is he mentioning anything about the lambs being little when they're not bringing a Churban Pesach anymore, because the Beis Hamikdash has been destroyed? And the question is on Rav Shimon Gamliel also, who was the next generation. So there's a couple of interesting points in that. There is an explanation that even after the Churban, they still continued to write that because they're hoping Meheira Yibane HaMikdash, the Beis HaMikdash may be rebuilt soon, and we need to prepare for that. We need to have, should Mashiach come this year, then Beis HaMikdash is rebuilt, then we need to have animals ready for the Korbanos. So therefore, they could mention that point even after the Churban. Rabbi Yaakov Emden brings up a point. He says that we find, based on, he explains various Gemaras to say that even after the Churban, to a certain extent, they were managed to sneak by the Romans and be able to bring Korbanos. The halacha is, after all, you can bring Korbanos even when the Beis Hamikdash has been destroyed, as long as you know the Makom HaMizbeach and you have Eifa Pora Adruma to make everybody Tahor and so on and so forth. So therefore, they may well have been able to actually bring Korbanos at times during those years, and therefore Rabbi Gamliel and even Rabbi Shimon Gamliel can be mentioning that point. And that would also explain how Rabbi Gamliel is able to sit on a step on the Har HaBayis after it was destroyed, because in other words, there's still parts of it are still standing, and therefore he's able to sit there and then dictate letters.
you can make a bus even though you can't put it on the mizbeach.
So that's as long as you know the place of the mizbeach, even if the actual physical mizbeach is destroyed, still the whole floor of the Azara has the kedusha of the mizbeach. And even if the heichal is not there, etc. Yeah. Later on in Jewish history, by the way, as far as the Korban Pesach particularly, since Tumah Hutro, Dechoya B'Tzibur, there were various times over the centuries when Chachamim made an attempt to bring a Korban Pesach nowadays, even though we're all Tomei. Famously, Rabbi Chiel of Paris moved here to Eretz Yisrael in the year Heyalofim Yud Zayin, in the year 1257, and he wanted to bring a Korban Pesach. And he was discussing with the Chachamim of his time, the other Balei HaTosfos, whether such a thing is possible. In the end, he wasn't able to do it, and they talked him out of it, and there were a variety of reasons why it couldn't happen, but over the centuries, various Chachamim have brought up the point again and again. Even in our times, after the Six-Day War, when the Harabayis was for a little while in Jewish hands, the Rebbe, for a few years after that, would tell people, don't be in Yerushalayim, in the old city of Yerushalayim, on Erev Pesach, because you might have to bring a Korban Pesach. Eventually, a few years later, after the situation had changed, and it would be dangerous for a person to go up onto the Harabayis to bring a Korban, then they'd have said in the mid-70s already, it's not necessary anymore, because obviously nobody's bringing a Korban Pesach. But in principle, such a thing might be possible, even though we're all Tmei and Mess, and even though we don't have Big Dick Kahuna, and so on and so forth, there is the possibility. But yeah. Anyway, one other point, though, is there are some Mefoshim who learn that the Rebbe Gamliel of this story over here is actually Rebbe Gamliel HaZakin. Now, he was still Nasi, his Nasius was still during the time of the second Mishmikdash. So that neatly explains how he can be sitting on a step on the Harabayis and dictating letters, and that, of course, explains how he's mentioning in his letters the animals are still young, etc. The only problem with that is we never find that he was deposed. So there's a different girsa that somebody showing him have, not Bosa da'abru hu, after he was removed, but rather, according to them, the girsa is Bosa da'abru ha, meaning after the year was declared a leap year. This goes back to the story that we had on Amud Aleph, where one time Ram Gamliel was out of town when they're deliberating whether to make a leap year, and they had to make it al tnai, whether he's going to agree or not. So when he came back, he would have to dictate the letter and say that I and my colleagues agreed, because he wasn't there at the time to say that they should do it. It had to be his colleagues decided it, and he agreed when he came back. So that would be a different answer. So in other words, according to that also, so according to the standard deuce that we have in front of us, in other words, the Gemara is saying that yes, Rav Gamliel himself, Rav Gamliel the Yavne, went through two stages. First, he wasn't such an onav, and therefore he treated Rabbi Yeshua the way he did. After he went through the whole thing with being deposed and Rabbi Lozman and Azari being appointed and all, he became an onav, the Gemara is saying. Or the other understanding, as we're saying, with Rabbi Gamliel himself, Rabbi Gamliel HaZakin, usually he would just write his letters saying that I said to make an Ibrayor, just like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel did in a later generation. But this particular time, because he wasn't there, therefore he had to write it in the plural form, because they were the ones who made the decision. Okay. The Gemara continues, Tanan Rabbanan, Al Shlosha Dvarim Ma'abir Nasashana. There are three major things that we use to consider whether to make a leap year. Now, in Oman Aleph, we learned other considerations. We learned about the roads and the bridges and whatnot. But those are not the primary reasons. Those are more also, like we said before, sad. Those are secondary factors, but here let's talk about the primary factors. Al Oviv, because of the Oviv. Now, Oviv does mean the spring, but actually, and I was explaining before that it means the spring equinox, but actually that's Al Tzkufa, which we're going to say over here. Al Oviv, the word Oviv actually means the ripe grain. So it means, Parshat, when they estimate based on the way the grain is growing, it's not going to be ripe enough in time for Pesach. Now the Pesach says you have to make Pesach b'chodesh Aviv, in the month of Aviv. So it has to be that there's already ripe grain. Now Rashi brings an explanation that some want to explain that it would mean the reason is because if the grain's not ripe, they're not going to have where to bring a korban omer for. But Rashi says that doesn't really fit with the continuation of the Gemara, because the Gemara is going to go on to mention the different regions of Eretz Yisrael, whereas they would bring the Omer only from Yehuda, so the other regions don't really matter so much. So no, it means Parshat, in other words, Pesach has to be B'chodesh Aviv, in the month of Aviv, and if the grain is not ripe, then it's not Chodesh Aviv yet. So that's the first factor. And because of the fruits that are not ripening in time. Now Rashi points out, in other words, the point is, Shavuos is the beginning of time of bringing Bikurim. So now, if the fruit is not going to be ripe enough Shavuos to bring Bikurim yet, it means everybody's going to have to be Matriach to come again some other time during the year to bring Bikurim, and it's going to be a schlep, and they're not going to bother. So therefore, we want to make it easy for them. So therefore, we want to make sure that the fruits we have to look at how the fruits are growing and estimate that they're going to be ripe enough by Shavuos, and if not, then we put in an extra month. And then there are different other Mephoshim talk about points about that. I mean, on the face of it, so what? They could also bring it Sukkot time. What's the problem? So the Yad Ramah points out that first of all, that's not a valid reason to make a leap year, and so what? They could bring it Sukkot time. So he says what it means is the Pusik says that Chag HaTzeres, that Shavuos has to be, it's also called Chag HaBikurim. So it has to be that's possible to bring Bikurim then, and if it's not, then it means that Shavuos is coming out too early in the solar year, and therefore that's a valid reason to make an Ibur year. So in other words, Ala Aviv would be because Pesach is coming too early in the agricultural year, and the grain is not ripe yet. And that's the point. In other words, so that's another factor. Well, sometimes one kind of crop are ripening faster than the other. So they have to consider it separately. They have to consider, is the grain going to be ripe by Pesach, so that'll be Chodesh Aviv, and are the tree fruits going to be ripe by Shavuos, so that'll be Chag HaBikurim. And the third is Vala Tekufa, and the third one is with the Tekufa. If Tekufas Nissen is coming out too late, if it's coming out past the 16th of Nissen. This, by the way, when we have nowadays, our fixed calendar still uses that rule. We have two different ways of calculating the Tekufa, two different ways of calculating the length of the secular year, of the solar year. We have Shmuel's method and Rav Abba's method. Shmuel's method, actually, sometimes the Tekufa does come out after Pesach. We use it, among other things, to decide when Birkas HaChama is. And Birkas HaChama occasionally comes out after Pesach. Then we have Rav Abba's calculation, and in fact, in Rav Abba's calculation, the Tekufa never comes out after the 16th of Nisan. If it does, then it means that year has to be a leap year and moves it up another month. So the Braisa continues. Al shnayim mehem avrim. If we have two or more of these factors, then we make a leap year. Val echad mehem ein avrim. If it's only one of them, then that's not a valid reason to make a leap year. Now, if one of the factors that they use to declare that it's a leap year is because of Aviv, because the grain is not ripe yet, then everybody is happy about it. Why is that? Because Rashi says, because, like this, when Pesach is a month later, it means it's also an extra month that nobody can eat Chodesh. Because you can't eat Chodesh, you can't eat the new crop of grain in Eretz Yisrael, and according to many poskim, even in Chutz La'aretz, until the Omer is brought on the second day of Pesach. Shavuos. And Shavuos is for Menachos. To bring Menachos, you can only bring Menachos from the new grain beginning Shavuos. But to eat the new grain, Chodesh, you have to wait until the second day of Pesach. So if there's a leap year, it means they have to wait a whole other month. Well, if anyway they're making a leap year because the grain is otherwise not going to be ripe, then everybody's happy. Look, we wouldn't have been able to eat the grain anyhow until Pesach comes. So therefore, we don't mind that there's a whole extra month to wait. Rav Shimon Gamliel and Ala Tekufa. Rav Shimon Gamliel says it was because of the Tekufa that they were. So that's the question. What does he mean by that? Iboilo Ala Tekufa Smechin or Ala Tekufa Ma'abrin? Does Rav Shimon Gamliel mean that the Tekufa is a reason also that people would be happy? Because it's not just if the crops are not ripe yet that people would be happy, they would understand there's a good reason for a leap year, but also if the Tekufa. Because, like this, what happens is, Rav Shimon Gamliel would be saying, listen, if you don't make a leap year, then it comes out that Sukkot time is still going to be during the summer. It's going to be at the tail end of the summer. So it'll be much more convenient to sit in the sukkah. You'll be much more comfortable over there. As opposed to if there's a leap year, then Sukkot comes out later, it's more likely to be the rainy season and cold, and people aren't going to like it as much. So does Rav Shimon Gamliel mean that when they make a leap year because of the Tekufa? But, in other words, the Tekufa itself would have been in time. It would have been that if it was because of the Tekufa, that Sukkot would still be coming out in its proper place in the solar year. But they're making a leap year because of other factors, then Rav Shimon Gamliel would say people have reason to be upset. Because it means that Sukkot is unnecessarily going to, so their way of thinking of it is going to be unnecessarily later in the year, and it's going to be cold and rainy. So does he mean that? Or does Rav Shimon Gamliel mean the Tekufa being late alone is a reason enough to declare a leap year, and we don't even worry about the other two factors? In other words, here we said you need two of the three, but Rav Shimon Gamliel says that no, if the Tekufa alone is reason enough to make a leap year independent of anything else. So the Moses Taker, we can't be sure what he means by that.
What do you mean by the Tekufa, exactly? What do you mean by the Tekufa?
Tekufa means the equinox. There's a certain day during there's a certain day during the year when the sun crosses the equator, and on that day, the day and the night are exactly 12 hours each. That's the official beginning.
Well, that doesn't change.
It doesn't change on the secular calendar. Every year on the secular calendar, it's March 20th or 21st. But in the Jewish calendar, it changes from year to year, right? So therefore, so you can have.
No.
Yeah.
the spring equinox is astronomical. It doesn't change.
I'm aware of that, but it changes its position relative to the Jewish year, because the Jewish year is about 11 days less, without a leap year, is about 11 days less than a solar year. So to put it in modern terms, now, first of all, by the way, let's talk in terms of Rav Adas Tkufa, because again, Rav Adas Tkufa is what our calendar nowadays is based on. So let's say, for example, according to Rav Ada, actually, his calculated date for the spring equinox for Tkufas Nissan nowadays is March 26th or 27th. So let's put it in modern terms then. So if you have 1 year, the first day Pesach is, let's say, April 20th. So good. That's within a month of all the, and therefore we're good. We don't need a leap year. The next year, it's going to be about 11 days earlier. So it'll be about April 9th. Still fine. The year after that, it's going to be about 11 days earlier than that, which is going to bring us to, March 29th. We're starting to get, it's getting a little bit out of whack, but we can still manage. But we wait another year. It's going to be, the Tkufa is going to come out March 18th. And that's too early already, because that's because here you're going to, the other way around, you're going to have, I said that wrongly. Let me try that again. Suppose that one year Pesach is April 20th. Yeah, the next year it's the 9th, the next year it's the 29th. Now, the Tkufa, let's say, is the 26th or 7th. So fine, we're still okay. But if we were to make another year without a leap year, the next year, Pesach, the first day of Pesach, would be March 18th. And that's too early. The Tkufa is the 26th or 27th. So then we have to make a leap year in order to keep Pesach in the spring.
For sure.
So the point is, Reb Shimon Gamliel, according to one way of understanding it, is saying just that alone is reason to make a leap year. And then what are we going to do? We're going to add another month, and then Pesach is going to come out. After we do that, then Pesach is going to come out. Instead of about March 18th, it's going to come out about April 18th, and that's fine. So is Reb Shimon Gamliel saying that alone is reason enough to make a leap year, even if otherwise the crops are ripening nicely and the animals are large and so on and so forth, but just the fact that the Tkufa is coming out after Pesach begins? Or is it that Reb Shimon Gamliel is just saying, as you should know, when are people happy, not just when we make a leap year because the grain is not ripe yet, but also when we make a leap year because of the Tkufa, because then it's not inconveniencing them as far as Sukkos. So how do we understand what he's saying? So the Gemara is saying Teiku. So the only factor we use nowadays, of course, since we have a fixed calendar, is the Tkufa. If any time Rav Adas Tkufa, again, is defined as coming out sometime on March 26th or 7th, if that comes out any later than the second day Pesach, then that year would be a leap year. So, for example, this past year, the first day Pesach was what, April 23rd, I think, or something. So fine. Next, this coming year, the first day Pesach is going to be about April 12th. So we're okay. The year after that, it's going to be about April 1st. Still fine. The year after that, if we didn't make a leap year coming up in the year 2027, then Pesach would come out in mid March, and that's too early. So instead, we make a leap year, and therefore Pesach comes out to be in mid-April, and that's how we work it. That's what we mean by the Tkufa.
So basically, the Tkufa is based on Pesach coming in March, and then we have to make a leap year.
Pesach can be in April many times also. But yeah, the point is, in other words, there is a certain day called the equinox, and Pesach has to be on or after that. Yeah.
All
right. The equinox is when, according
well, that's
to
what I'm
the,
saying. Astronomically, nowadays, the equinox is March 20th or 21st. Rav Ada's calculation places it on the 26th or 27th because of reasons that I'm not going to get into right now. So we use Rav Ada's calculation then to determine when there's a leap year. Any time when, if it weren't for there being a leap year, Pesach would be any time before March 25th. Then we make a leap year that year, and therefore Pesach is pushed ahead a month.
And that happens how many times on a cycle?
So nowadays we have a fixed cycle of 19 years, and it happens 7 times during the cycle, every 2 or 3 years. So we have the 3rd, 6th, 8th, 11th, 14th, 17th, and 19th years of the cycle are leap years. In the times when we're talking about, when the Sanhedrin decided it, then there wasn't a cycle. There was approximately a cycle, but we'll talk about that tomorrow. That's the sham, but they didn't necessarily have to stick to it exclusively.
And when the temple is going to be rebuilt, are we going to take both methods, or are we just going to stick to the Tkufa method only?
Well, there'll be a Sanhedrin again. They can determine leap years. So the fascists will go back to that method. Well, they'll determine leap years depending on the factors, whether they'll use only the Tkufa or whether they're going to use the other factors as well. I guess we'll have to see. The fascists
they'll
are
have
follow,
to use both because
the fascists are going to follow the halachas we have in the Gemara over here. What?
They'll have to follow both because we're going to offer korbanos again.
Indeed, so they'll have to take that into consideration. Yeah. I mean, one thing to point out, of course, is they may not have to consider that so much about the growth of the animals in Eretz Yisrael, since it'll be easy enough to import animals from other parts of the world, you know, so they may not have to factor that in, but I guess we'll see. All right, onward. The Gemara says, Tanan Abanan, Al Sholosh Arotis Ma'abrin Asashana. There are three regions of Eretz Yisrael that they take into consideration to decide. Now we said, another again, you have the Peres, you have the Tvua and the Oviv and the Peres Ilon. Those are going to vary in different places. Different places, things grow at different rates and at different times. So they have three areas in Eretz Yisrael to consider when they look at those. Yehuda, the Eber HaYarden, VaGolol. You have Yehuda, you have Eber HaYarden, the area across the Yarden where Reuben and Gad and Chatzi Shevet Menashe lived, and you have the Golol, the north of Eretz Yisrael. Al Shtayim Mehen Ma'abin VaAlach. They can make a leap year when two of them have not reached that stage yet, and even though one has. So in other words, let's say, for example, Yehuda and Eber HaYarden being further south, their growth season is going to be faster. The Golil being further north, then it's going to take longer for things to grow over there. So let's say, for example, we have the point where in Eretz Yehuda, in Eretz Yehuda, in the south of Eretz Yisrael, the crops are already mature. But let's say Eber HaYarden and the Golil have not yet. There is a little further north, and therefore the grain is not ripe yet, or they estimate by the time Pesach comes, the grain is not going to be ripe yet, or the tree fruits are not going to be ripe by Shavuos yet, in Basin's estimation. They still can't declare, so they could use that to declare a leap year. The grain in Yehuda is already ripe, and then we shouldn't be declaring an Eber year, but the fact that two out of the three regions of Eretz Yisrael, it's not ripe, that's a valid reason to consider in making a leap year. Now, when the land of Yehuda is one of them, Hakol Smechin, then everybody is happy because, again, then everybody realizes we had good reason to add a second Adar and therefore to delay eating Chodesh by a month. She'ein Omer be'elam Yehuda, because after all, the Korban Omer, the wheat, the grain for it, the barley for it, can come only from Yehuda. So when the barley is already ripe in Yehuda, but it's not yet ripe in Eber HaYarden and the Golil, then people are going to be grumbling. Why are Beis Din making us have to wait a whole nother month to eat Chodesh? Is it just because they can't bring the Korban Omer? The grain in Yehuda is ripe already. They can just bring it from the barley in Yehuda and have done with it. Why are they making us a leap year and making us an extra month of a year? But like this, when in Yehuda itself the barley is not ripe yet, everybody is happy because then everybody understands, okay, well, they had a very good reason to make a leap year because, look, if they didn't do that, they wouldn't have ripe barley to be able to bring the Korban Omer. And without a Korban Omer, we can't eat Chodesh anyhow.
So they made a leap year when Yehuda was ripe?
No, so what we're saying is that even if the grain in Yehuda is ripe, if it's not yet ripe in Eber HaYarden and in Golil, which are the other two major regions of Eretz Yisrael, that would still be a valid reason to make, that would still be one of the valid factors to consider in making a leap year. If then they have one of the other factors, then that's it, then they can declare a leap year based on that. But the point is, then people are not going to be so happy, then people are going to be complaining, why do you do that? Is it... We farmers don't understand. We simple people don't understand all the considerations that the Chachamim go into in making a leap year. But we know they have to bring a Korban Omer, fine. But so what? They could have brought the Korban Omer this year without making a second Adar. The grain in Yehuda is ripe already. Why are they imposing on us a whole extra month to wait until eating Chodesh? So people will accept it. Okay, they don't have a choice but to accept what Beis Din says, but they're not going to be so happy about it. As opposed to if the grain is not ripe in Yehuda yet, and in one other area, and therefore they use that as one of the factors, then everybody will be happy because everybody will understand, okay, now there's a very good reason they had to make a leap year, because otherwise how are they going to bring the Korban Omer?
No, that was, of course. But if the grain is ripe in Yehuda, why can they make, why do they have to make a leap year? They can export the grain from...
That's not the
point. They can export the grain from Yehuda to Galil and Eder Ayazan.
Maybe they could, but the point is, since we're saying that since Pesach has to be in Chodesh HaOviv, implying there has to be Oviv, there has to be ripe grain at that time of Nissan, then therefore, if they evaluate and they see that in two of the three regions in Eretz Yisrael it's not yet going to be Oviv, then they can use that as a basis to declare a leap year. They can use that as one of the bases to declare a leap year, plus as long as they have another factor.
One second. Al-Tialacha, do you need the three regions to be
You need two out of the three regions to have reached the stage of Oviv, otherwise we say Oviv has not arrived yet. And then we have one factor, now we have to see, what about the other factors? What's doing with the fruits on the trees? What's doing with the tekufa? Yeah.
That's Midrabanan, the two out of three, or it's Midoraisa?
The Pashtus, we're assuming it's Midoraisa, or at least, I mean, when it comes to deciding when Rosh Chodesh is and when leap years are, the Torah gives the Hashem gives the Beis Din very broad powers, so maybe it's Midrabanan, I don't know, but whatever it is, it's up to the Beis Din to make this decision, yeah.
And it can be any two out of three, or not?
Any two out of three,
that's
what we're saying, yeah. Okay, Tana and we continue in another Braisa. Ein Ma'abanas Hashana El Yehuda. We can declare a leap year only in Yehuda, only in that southern region of Eretz Yisrael. V'imibruah b'Golil. If they did declare a leap year in Golil, mu'uberes and b'di'evres mu'uber. However, Heyed Chananya Ish Oinoi, however, Chananya from Oinoi, which is a city in Eretz Yisrael, gave Eidos in front of the Beis Din, imigruah b'Golil einu mu'uberes. He says that no, if they declare a leap year in Golil, then even b'di'evres, it's not a valid leap year. It has to be done in Yehuda. Amr of Yehuda Breder of Shimon Pazi, my timer. So, where Yehuda Breder of Shimon Pazi says, why would my timer to Chananiah Ish Oinoi? Why does Chananiah Ish Oinoi insist that it has to be done in Yehuda? Omar Kro, because the Pasuk says, L'shichnei Sidrashu. You should seek out the place of Hashem's Shechina, or Vosa Shoma, and you should come there. So in context, it's talking about coming there to bring Korbanos in the Beis Mikdash. But we also darshin, kol drisha sha'ata dervish, whenever you're seeking out something, whenever Beis Din is gathering to seek out something on behalf of the Jewish people, namely in this case, to seek out and to decide whether we need a leap year, they have to be in the neighborhood of the Shechina, in the neighborhood of Yerushalayim, which means in Eretz Yehuda. So therefore, that's why Chananiah Ish Oinoi says it must be taking place in Yehuda, which is near Yerushalayim. And if not, then he says, the Pasuk is implying that it cannot be done otherwise. Now, Tosfos points out there are examples in the Gemara here and there where a leap year was declared outside of that. The Gemara mentions at the end of Yevamos, the Mishnah mentions at the end of Yevamos, that Rabbi Akiva one time went to Nahudah, which is in Babel, and declared a leap year there. There are a couple of other examples here and there in Shas. We're going to have an example of it actually later in our Masechta. So Tosfos discusses that it's different because when Rabbi Akiva left Eretz Yisrael, there was nobody of his caliber left in Eretz Yisrael. He was the greatest of the Chachamim of his time. Therefore, such a thing is allowed. But when there are Chachamim of that caliber in Eretz Yisrael, then Chananiah Ish Oinoi is saying they must do it in Eretz Yisrael and they cannot do it anywhere else. Okay, and then Tosfos discusses again, and later on in our Masechta, we're going to talk about people who were going to declare a leap year outside of Eretz Yisrael, and we have other examples like that. Well, so Tosfos discusses that there it doesn't necessarily mean to declare the leap year, just means to do the calculations, to calculate whether they need to make a leap year, which sometimes is very intricate sometimes, and sometimes they didn't have the peace to do it in Eretz Yisrael because of the Romans, so they would have to travel to a different country to do it. With that said, Tosfos brings from the Yerushalmi, when you can't do it in Eretz Yisrael, then you're allowed to do it in Chutz Laaretz. And he mentions, for example, you have the example where during Golus Babel, Yirmiyah and Yechezkel and Boruch Beneria in their times declared Kiddush HaChodesh and Ibra Hashana in Babel, because there were no Jews in Eretz Yisrael. Then the Gemara continues, Tana Rabbanan, Ein Ma'abanas Hashana El Bayoyin. We can declare a leap year only by day. If they declare it by night, then it's not a valid leap year. We're going to see soon. Ein Makadshin El Bayoyin, similarly as far as Kiddush HaChodesh, they can only do it by day. And if they declare Kiddush HaChodesh, if they say Makudush HaChodesh by night, it doesn't work either. Amr of Abba Maikra, where's the Pasuk where we see that? The Pasuk says, Tikul b'chodesh shofar, blow the shofar on the chodesh, on Rosh Chodesh, b'kesel yom chagenu, on the appointed time of the day of our yomtiv. So that means, v'ezu chag shachodesh miskasaboy, which yomtiv is it, b'kesel, is maloshin kisui, which yomtiv is it when the moon is covered, is it, which yomtiv comes out on Rosh Chodesh, heviem is the Rosh Hashanah. Uchtiv, and the next pasuk continues. Kichoik liYisraelu. It's a choik. It's a law for Yisrael. Mishpat leLekei Yaakov. It's a judgment for the God of Yaakov, from which we learn. In other words, ma mishpat bayoyim, just like judgment has to be done by day, as we're going to learn later on in our Masechta, that even dinei momenus have to be begun by day, and dinei nefashos has to be completed by day as well. The verdict has to be given by day. Af kiddush hachodesh bayoyim, the same way kiddush hachodesh has to davka be by day. And then the Yad Ramah explains that Ibra Shana is also, because the dates of the Yom Tovim depend on Ibra Shana as well, so we learn from that it has to be done by day. One point that comes out of that, by the way, the Mishnah tells us in Masechta Rosh Hashanah, suppose that even the members of the Sanhedrin themselves saw the moon right before Shkia. Now, usually it happens that you would only see the moon after Shkia, because usually it's the new moon is washed out by the sun. But sometimes it can happen you manage to see it shortly before Shkia. If Beis Din has the opportunity to sit quickly and to say Mekodesh HaChodesh, then good, they still had time. But if they waited and they didn't have a chance to say Mekodesh HaChodesh until the night time, then they can't do it by night. They have to wait till the next morning. In fact, the Mishnah goes even further. What happens, for example, let's say the moon was visible the night after the 29th, and Edim come the next day. But what if after cross-examining them, Beis Din did not have a chance to say Mekodesh HaChodesh until nightfall? Too late. That month becomes a Chodesh Mo'over. Edim came, and the moon was visible, and we checked down and everything, but they didn't say the words Mekodesh HaChodesh, then it becomes a 30-day month. So therefore, so we see that Kodesh HaChodesh always has to take place by day, and the Gemara is telling us that Ibar HaShana, declaring a leap year, also Dafka has to take place by day.
So it cannot be said Ben Hashmashas, you're saying?
So Ben Hashmashas would be a suffix. Maybe they can't, I don't know, but the Rambam uses the expression Yotza Koichav Leil Shloshim when the first stars come out on the night of the 30th, so maybe the Rambam is implying that they could say it till Tzeisa Kachovim, I don't know, but in any case, they can't do it when it's definitely night, yeah.
Mm.
Okay.